This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Effective Executive, The Definitive Guide to Getting the Right Things Done, 50th Anniversary Edition, by Peter Drucker. Read by Tim Andres Pabon, with a foreword written and read by Jim Collins.
10 Lessons That I Learned from Peter Drucker, by Jim Collins. This is my foreword to the 50th anniversary edition of the great classic work, The Effective Executive. If you are to read one book on executive self-management, it should be this, Peter Drucker's definitive classic, The Effective Executive. It doesn't matter the size of your organization, or even whether you run an organization at all. Anyone who has responsibility for getting the right things done. Anyone who seeks how best to self-deploy on the few priorities that will make the biggest impact is an executive. The most effective among us have the same number of hours as everyone else. Yet, they deploy them better, often much better, than people with far greater raw talent. As Drucker states early in these pages, people endowed with tremendous brilliance are often strikingly ineffectual. And if that's true for the exceptionally brilliant, what hope is there for the rest of us? Actually, there is something much better than hope. Drucker's practical disciplines. I first read The Effective Executive in my early 30s, and it was a huge inflection point in my own development. Reading the text again, I'm reminded of how its lessons became deeply ingrained, almost as a set of commandments. Some of Drucker's examples and language might be dated, but the insights are timeless and modern. As helpful today as when he wrote them more than 5 decades ago. Here in this foreword, I offer 10 lessons that I learned from Peter Drucker and this book, and that I offer as a small portal of entry into the mind of the greatest management thinker of all time. Number one. First, manage thyself. That one can truly manage other people is by no means adequately proven, Drucker writes. But one can always manage oneself. How can you possibly expect others to perform at the highest levels without first expecting that of yourself? Drucker lays out a law of organized performance. The ratio of a leader's performance to those on his or her team remains constant. Therefore, if you want the average performance of those around you to go up, you must first improve your own performance. Number two, do what you're made for. One of Drucker's most arresting points is that we are all incompetent at most things. The crucial question is not how to turn incompetence into excellence, but to ask, what can a person do uncommonly well? This leads inevitably to a conclusion. Your first responsibility is to determine your own distinctive competencies. What can you do uncommonly well? What are you truly made for? And then navigate your life and career in direct alignment. To focus on weakness is not only foolish, it is irresponsible, challenges Drucker. Does Drucker's build on strength imperative mean never confronting our or others' deficiencies? yes and no. It means that if you're made to be a distance runner, don't try to be a middle linebacker. At the same time, you must address deficiencies that directly impede full flowering of your strength. When Michael Jordan was reaching the end of his basketball career, he could no longer fly to the basket with the same height and power as when he was younger. So he began to build a strength he'd never previously had, a fade-away jumper. He eradicated a crucial weakness within his strength, turning his fade-away jumper into yet another Jordan can kill you strength on the court. Do what you're made for, yes, but then get better and better. Eradicate weakness, yes, but only within your strength. Number 3. Work how you work best and let others do the same. If you're a tool put here on this earth to be useful, how does the tool best work? Some people work well at night. Others work better in the morning. Some absorb information best by reading. Others by listening. Some thrive in full immersion. Others work better in short bursts with variety in the day. Some are project-oriented. Others are process-oriented. Some need vacations. Others think the best part about vacations is that they end. Some prefer teams, whereas others produce much greater impact working alone. Per Drucker, we are wired for ways of working the same way that we are right-handed or left-handed. I discovered early that I cannot exchange morning creative hours for afternoon creative hours. The morning ones are always better. Drucker gave me the confidence to calendar white space in the morning and to be belligerently reclusive during those creative hours. No one but you can take responsibility to leverage how you best work. And the sooner you do, the more years you have to gain the cumulative effect of tens of thousands of hours well spent. Number 4. Count your time and make it count. Drucker taught that what gets measured gets managed. So how can we possibly hope to manage our time if we don't measure precisely where our time goes? Inspired by Drucker's challenge, I've kept a spreadsheet with one key metric, the number of creative hours logged each day, with the self-imposed imperative to stay above 1,000 creative hours a year. This mechanism keeps me on the creative march, doing research, developing concepts and writing, despite ever-increasing demands for travel, team leadership, and working with executives. But you also have to make your time count. The secret of people who do so many difficult things, writes Drucker, is that they do only one thing at a time. They refuse to let themselves be squandered away in small driblets that are no time at all. This requires the discipline to consolidate time into blocks of 3 primary types. First, create unbroken blocks for individual think time, preferably during the most lucid time of your day. These pockets of quietude might be only 90 minutes, but even the busiest executive must do them with regularity. Second, create chunks of deliberately unstructured time for people and the inevitable stuff that comes up. And third, engage in meetings that matter, making particular use of carefully constructed standing meetings that can be the heartbeat of dialogue and debate and decision. And use some of your think time to prepare and follow up. Number 5, prepare better meetings. The oft-repeated quip, "I'm sorry to write you a long letter as I did not have time to write a short one," could be applied to meetings. "I'm sorry to imprison you in this long meeting as I did not have time to prepare a short one." Effective people develop a recipe for how to make the most of meetings, and they employ their recipes with consistent discipline. And while there are many varieties of good meeting recipes, just as there are many recipes for baking tasty cookies, Drucker highlights two common ingredients. One, preparation with a clear purpose in mind. Why are we having this meeting? And two, disciplined follow-up. Those who make the most of meetings frequently spend substantially more time preparing for the meeting than in the meeting itself. To abuse other people's time by failing to prepare shorter, better meetings amounts to stealing a portion of their lives. And while we must all lead or join meetings, they should be limited to those that do the most useful work. If meetings come to dominate your time, then your life is likely being ill-spent. Number 6, don't make 100 decisions when one will do. We're continually hit by a blizzard of situations, opportunities, problems, incidents, all of which seem to demand decisions. Yes, no, go, no go, buy, sell, attack, retreat, accept, reject, reply, ignore, invest, harvest, hire. It can feel like chaos. But the most effective people find the patterns within the chaos. In Drucker's view, we rarely face truly unique one-off decisions. And there's an overhead cost to any good decision. It requires argument and debate, time for reflection and concentration, and energy expended to ensure superb execution. So given this overhead cost, it's far better to zoom out, make a few big generic decisions that can apply to a large number of specific situations, to find a pattern within. In short, to go from chaos to concept. Think of it as akin to Warren Buffett making investment decisions. Buffett learned to ignore the vast majority of possibilities almost as background noise. Instead, he made a few big decisions, such as the decision to shift from buying mediocre companies at very cheap prices to buying great earnings machines at good prices, and then replicated that generic decision over and over again. For Drucker, those who grasp Buffett's point that inactivity can be very intelligent behavior are much more effective than those who make hundreds of decisions with no coherent concept. Number 7, find your one big distinctive impact. When a friend of mine became the chairman of the board of trustees of a leading university, he posed a question. How will I know if I've done a great job? I pondered what Drucker would say, and then answered, identify one big thing that would most contribute to the future of the university and orchestrate getting it done. If you make one distinctive contribution, a key decision that would not have happened without your leadership, even if no one ever credits you for your catalytic role, then you will have rendered a great service. Drucker applied this idea to his own consulting. When I asked him what he contributed to his clients, he modestly said, "I've generally learned more from them than they learned from me." Then, pausing for effect, he added, "Of course, in each case, there was one absolutely fundamental decision they would not have made without me." So what is your one absolutely fundamental contribution that would not happen without you? Number 8. Stop what you would not start. The presence of an ever-expanding to-do list without a robust stop-doing list is a lack of discipline. To focus on priorities means clearing away the clutter. Sometimes the best way to deal with a platter piled high with problems is simply to toss the entire pile into the trash, wash the platter, and start anew. Above all, we must not starve our biggest opportunities because we're so busy throwing ourselves at our biggest problems and dwelling on past mistakes. Pivot from past to future. Create forward. Always ask, what's next? Yet how to do this when past problems clamor for our attention, when we live with the accumulated legacy of what came before? Drucker gives an answer in the form of a question, one of the most impactful in his arsenal. If it were a decision today to start something you are already in, to enter a business, to hire a person, to institute a policy, to launch a project, and so forth, would you? If not, well, then why do you persist? Number 9. Run lean. One of Drucker's most important insights is that an organization is like a biological organism in one key way. Internal mass grows at a faster rate than external surface. Thus, as the organization grows, an increasing proportion of energy diverts to managing the internal mass, rather than contributing to the outside world. Combine this with another Druckerian truth. The accomplishments of a single right person in a key seat dwarfs the combined accomplishment of dividing the same seat among multiple B players. Get better people. Give them really big things to do. Enlarge their responsibilities and let them work. Resist the temptation to redesign seats on the bus to specific personalities, except for the exceptionally rare genius, as this will inevitably create seats you do not need. The fewer people, the smaller, the less activity inside, writes Drucker, the more nearly perfect is the organization. Number 10. Be useful. When I was just 36, Tom Brown, editor of Industry Week magazine, somehow got Drucker to invite me to visit with him in Claremont. I clicked on my answering machine one day after teaching my classes at Stanford and heard a resonant Austrian accent. "This is Peter Drucker." When I called him back to arrange a day, I asked if I should schedule with his assistant, to which he replied, "I am my own secretary." He lived a simple life. No staff, no research assistants, no formal office. He typed on a clickety-clack old typewriter set at 90 degrees off of a small desk, working in the spare bedroom of a modest house. He met in his living room with powerful CEOs, sitting not at a desk, but in a wicker chair. And yet, with this minimalist method, Drucker stood as the most impactful management thinker of the 20th century. My first meeting with Drucker is one of the 10 most significant days in my own life. Peter had dedicated himself to one huge question. How can we make society both more productive and more humane? His warmth, as when he grasped my hand in two of his, upon opening his front door, "Mr. Collins, so very pleased to meet you, please come inside," bespoke his own humanity. But he was also incredibly productive. At one point, I asked him which of his 26 books he was most proud of, to which Drucker, then 86 years old or young, depending on how you look at it, I look at it as young, replied, "The next one." He wrote 10 more. At the end of that day, Peter hit me with a challenge. I was on the cusp of leaving my faculty spot at Stanford, betting on a self-created path, and I was scared. "It seems to me you spend a lot of time worrying about how you will survive," said Peter.
"You will probably survive."
He continued, "And you seem to spend a lot of energy on the question of how to be successful. But that is the wrong question." He paused. Then, like a Zen master thwacking the table with a bamboo stick, "The question is, how to be useful." A great teacher can change your life in 30 seconds. We're all given only one short life, composed of the same 168 hours a week as everyone else. What will it add up to? How will other people's lives be changed? What difference will it make? Peter Drucker, one man with no organization, a modest house, and a wicker chair, models how much one highly effective person can contribute, and that we should never confuse scale of impact with scale of organization. He was, in the end, the highest level of what a teacher can be, a role model of the very ideas he taught, a walking testament to his teachings in the tremendous, lasting effect of his own life.
Preface. Management books usually deal with managing other people. The subject of this audiobook is managing oneself for effectiveness. That one can truly manage other people is by no means adequately proven, but one can always manage oneself. Indeed, executives who don't manage themselves for effectiveness cannot possibly expect to manage their associates and subordinates. Management is largely by example. Executives who don't know how to make themselves effective in their own job and work set the wrong example. To be reasonably effective, it's not enough for the individual to be intelligent, to work hard, or to be knowledgeable. Effectiveness is something separate, something different. But to be effective also doesn't require special gifts, special aptitude, or special training. Effectiveness as an executive demands doing certain and fairly simple things. It consists of a small number of practices, the practices that are presented and discussed in this audiobook, but these practices are not quote-unquote inborn. In 45 years of work as a consultant with a large number of executives in a wide variety of organizations, large and small, businesses, government agencies, labor unions, hospitals, universities, community services, American, European, Latin American, and Japanese, I have not come across a single quote-unquote natural an executive who was born effective. All the effective ones have had to learn to be effective, and all of them then had to practice effectiveness until it became habit. But all the ones who worked on making themselves effective executives succeeded in doing so. Effectiveness can be learned, and it also has to be learned. Effectiveness is what executives are being paid for, whether they work as managers who are responsible for the performance of others as well as their own, or as individual professional contributors responsible for their own performance only. Without effectiveness, there's no performance, no matter how much intelligence and knowledge goes into the work, no matter how many hours it takes. Yet it's perhaps not too surprising that we have so far paid little attention to the effective executive. Organizations, whether business enterprises, large government agencies, labor unions, large hospitals, or large universities, are after all brand new. A century ago, almost no one had much contact with such organizations, beyond an occasional trip to the local post office to mail a letter. And effectiveness as an executive means effectiveness in and through an organization. Until recently, there was little reason for anyone to pay much attention to the effective executive or to worry about the low effectiveness of so many others. Now, however, most people, especially those with even a fair amount of schooling, can expect to spend all their working lives in an organization of some kind. Society has become a society of organizations in all developed countries. Now the effectiveness of the individual depends increasingly on his or her ability to be effective in an organization, to be effective as an executive, and the effectiveness of a modern society and its ability to perform, perhaps even its ability to survive, depend increasingly on the effectiveness of the people who work as executives in the organizations. The effective executive is fast becoming a key resource for society, and effectiveness as an executive is a prime requirement for individual accomplishment and achievement for young people at the beginning of their working lives, fully as much as for people in mid-career. Introduction. What makes an effective executive? By Peter F. Drucker. An effective executive does not need to be a leader in the sense that the term is now most commonly used. Harry Truman did not have 1 ounce of charisma, for example, yet he was among the most effective chief executives in U.S. history. Similarly, some of the best business and nonprofit CEOs I've worked with over a 65-year consulting career were not stereotypical leaders. They were all over the map in terms of their personalities, attitudes, values, strengths, and weaknesses. They ranged from extroverted to nearly reclusive, from easygoing to controlling, from generous to parsimonious. What made them all effective is that they followed the same 8 practices. 1. They asked, what needs to be done? 2. They asked, what is right for the enterprise? 3. They developed action plans. 4. They took responsibility for decisions. 5. They took responsibility for communicating. 6. They were focused on opportunities rather than problems. 7. They ran productive meetings. And 8. They thought and said we rather than I. The first 2 practices gave them the knowledge they needed. The next 4 helped them convert this knowledge into effective action. The last 2 ensured that the whole organization felt responsible and accountable. Get the knowledge you need. The first practice is to ask what needs to be done. Note that the question is not, what do I want to do? Asking what has to be done and taking the question seriously is crucial for managerial success. Failure to ask this question will render even the ablest executive ineffectual. When Truman became president in 1945, he knew exactly what he wanted to do: complete the economic and social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal, which had been deferred by World War II. As soon as he asked what needed to be done, though, Truman realized that foreign affairs had absolute priority. He organized his working day so that it began with tutorials on foreign policy by the secretaries of state and defense. As a result, he became the most effective president in foreign affairs the United States has ever known. He contained communism in both Europe and Asia, and with the Marshall Plan triggered 50 years of worldwide economic growth. Similarly, Jack Welch realized that what needed to be done at General Electric when he took over as chief executive was not the overseas expansion he wanted to launch. It was getting rid of GE businesses that, no matter how profitable, couldn't be number 1 or number 2 in their industries. The answer to the question, what needs to be done, almost always contains more than one urgent task, but effective executives don't splinter themselves. They concentrate on one task, if at all possible. If they are among those people, a sizable minority, who work best with a change of pace in their working day, they pick two tasks. I have never encountered an executive who remains effective while tackling more than two tasks at a time. Hence, after asking what needs to be done, the effective executive sets priorities and sticks to them. For a CEO, the priority task might be redefining the company's mission. For a unit head, it might be redefining the unit's relationship with headquarters. Other tasks, no matter how important or appealing, are postponed. However, after completing the original top priority task, the executive resets priorities rather than moving on to number two from the original list. He asks, what must be done now? This generally results in new and different priorities. To refer again to America's best-known CEO, every 5 years, according to his autobiography, Jack Welch asked himself, what needs to be done now? And every time, he came up with a new and different priority. But Welch also thought through another issue before deciding where to concentrate his efforts for the next 5 years. He asked himself which of the two or three tasks at the top of the list he himself was best suited to undertake. Then he concentrated on that task. The others he delegated. Effective executives try to focus on jobs they'll do especially well. They know that enterprises perform if top management performs, and don't if it doesn't. Effective executives' second practice, fully as important as the first, is to ask, is this the right thing for the enterprise? They don't ask if it's right for the owners, the stock price, the employees, or the executives. Of course they know that shareholders, employees, and executives are important constituencies who have to support a decision or at least acquiesce in it if the choice is to be effective. They know that the share price is important not only for the shareholders, but also for the enterprise, since the price-to-earnings ratio sets the cost of capital. But they also know that a decision that isn't right for the enterprise will ultimately not be right for any of the stakeholders. This second practice is especially important for executives at family-owned or family-run businesses, the majority of businesses in every country, particularly when they're making decisions about people. In the successful family company, a relative is promoted only if he or she is measurably superior to all non-relatives on the same level. At DuPont, for instance, all top managers, except the controller and lawyer, were family members in the early years when the firm was run as a family business. All male descendants of the founders were entitled to entry-level jobs at the company. Beyond the entrance level, a family member got a promotion only if a panel composed primarily of non-family managers judge the person to be superior in ability and performance to all other employees at the same level. The same rule was observed for a century in the highly successful British family business J. Lyons & Company, now part of a major conglomerate, when it dominated the British food service and hotel industries. Asking what is right for the enterprise doesn't guarantee that the right decision will be made. Even the most brilliant executive is human and thus prone to mistakes and prejudices. But failure to ask the question virtually guarantees the wrong decision. Write an action plan. Executives are doers. They execute. Knowledge is useless to executives until it has been translated into deeds. But before springing into action, the executive needs to plan his course. He needs to think about desired results, probable restraints, future revisions, check-in points, and implications for how he'll spend his time. First, the executive defines desired results by asking, what contributions should the enterprise expect from me over the next 18 months to 2 years? What results will I commit to? With what deadlines? Then he considers the restraints on action. Is this course of action ethical? Is it acceptable within the organization? Is it legal? Is it compatible with the mission, values, and policies of the organization? Affirmative answers don't guarantee that the action will be effective, but violating these restraints is certain to make it both wrong and ineffectual. The action plan is a statement of intentions rather than a commitment. It must not become a straitjacket. It should be revised often because every success creates new opportunities. So does every failure. The same is true for changes in the business environment, in the market, and especially in people within the enterprise.
all these changes demand that the plan be revised. A written plan should anticipate the need for flexibility. In addition, the action plan needs to create a system for checking the results against the expectations. Effective executives usually build two such checks into their action plans. The first check comes halfway through the plan's time period, for example, at 9 months. The second occurs at the end before the next action plan is drawn up. Finally, the action plan has to become the basis for the executive's time management. Time is an executive's scarcest and most precious resource, and organizations, whether government agencies, businesses, or nonprofits, are inherently time wasters. The action plan will prove useless unless it's allowed to determine how the executive spends his or her time. Napoleon allegedly said that no successful battle ever followed its plan, yet Napoleon also planned every one of his battles far more meticulously than any earlier general had done. Without an action plan, the executive becomes a prisoner of events, and without check-ins to re-examine the plan as events unfold, the executive has no way of knowing which events really matter and which are only noise. Act. When they translate plans into action, executives need to pay particular attention to decision-making, communication, opportunities, as opposed to problems, and meetings. I'll consider these one at a time. Take responsibility for decisions. A decision has not been made until people know, 1, the name of the person accountable for carrying it out, 2, the deadline, 3, the names of the people who will be affected by the decision and therefore have to know about, understand, and approve it, or at least not be strongly opposed to it, and 4, the names of the people who have to be informed of the decision, even if they're not directly affected by it. An extraordinary number of organizational decisions run into trouble because these bases aren't covered. One of my clients, 30 years ago, lost its leadership position in the fast-growing Japanese market because the company, after deciding to enter into a joint venture with a new Japanese partner, never made clear who was to inform the purchasing agents that the partner defined its specifications in meters and kilograms rather than feet and pounds, and nobody ever did relay that information. It's just as important to review decisions periodically, at a time that's been agreed on in advance, as it is to make them carefully in the first place. That way, a poor decision can be corrected before it does real damage. These reviews can cover anything from the results to the assumptions underlying the decision. Such a review is especially important for the most crucial and most difficult of all decisions, the ones about hiring or promoting people. Studies of decisions about people show that only 1/3 of such choices turn out to be truly successful. 1/3 are likely to be draws, neither successes nor outright failures, and 1/3 are failures, pure and simple. Effective executives know this and check up 6 to 9 months later on the results of their people decisions. If they find that a decision has not had the desired results, they don't conclude that the person hasn't performed. They conclude instead that they themselves made a mistake. In a well-managed enterprise, it's understood that people who fail in a new job, especially after a promotion, may not be the ones to blame. Executives also owe it to the organization and to their fellow workers not to tolerate non-performing individuals in important jobs. It may not be the employee's fault that they are underperforming, but even so, they have to be removed. People who have failed in a new job should be given the choice to go back to a job at their former level and salary. This option is rarely exercised. Such people as a rule leave voluntarily, at least when their employers are U.S. firms. But the very existence of the option can have a powerful effect, encouraging people to leave safe, comfortable jobs and take risky new assignments. The organization's performance depends on employees' willingness to take such chances. A systematic decision review can be a powerful tool for self-development, too. Checking the results of a decision against its expectations shows executives what their strengths are, where they need to improve, and where they lack knowledge or information. It shows them their biases. Very often it shows them that their decisions didn't produce results because they didn't put the right people on the job. Allocating the best people to the right positions is a crucial, tough job that many executives slight, in part because the best people are already too busy. Systematic decision review also shows executives their own weaknesses, particularly the areas in which they are simply incompetent. In these areas, smart executives don't make decisions or take actions, they delegate. Everyone has such areas. There's no such thing as a universal executive genius. Most discussions of decision-making assume that only senior executives make decisions, or that only senior executives' decisions matter. This is a dangerous mistake. Decisions are made at every level of the organization, beginning with individual professional contributors and frontline supervisors. These apparently low-level decisions are extremely important in a knowledge-based organization. Knowledge workers are supposed to know more about their areas of specialization, for example, tax accounting, than anybody else. So their decisions are likely to have an impact throughout the company. Making good decisions is a crucial skill at every level. It needs to be taught explicitly to everyone in organizations that are based on knowledge. Take responsibility for communicating. Effective executives make sure that both their action plans and their information needs are understood. Specifically, this means that they share their plans with and ask for comments from all their colleagues, superiors, subordinates, and peers. At the same time, they let each person know what information they'll need to get the job done. The information flow from subordinate to boss is usually what gets the most attention, but executives need to pay equal attention to peers' and superiors' information needs. We all know, thanks to Chester Barnard's 1938 classic, The Functions of the Executive, that organizations are held together by information rather than by ownership or command. Still, far too many executives behave as if information and its flow were the job of the information specialist, for example, the accountant. As a result, they get an enormous amount of data they don't need and can't use, but little of the information they do need. The best way around this problem is for each executive to identify the information he needs, ask for it, and keep pushing until he gets it. Focus on opportunities. Good executives focus on opportunities rather than problems. Problems have to be taken care of course, they must not be swept under the rug, but problem solving, however necessary, doesn't produce results. It prevents damage. Exploiting opportunities produces results. Above all, effective executives treat change as an opportunity rather than a threat. They systematically look at changes inside and outside the corporation and ask, how can we exploit this change as an opportunity for our enterprise? Specifically, executives scan these seven situations for opportunities. First, an unexpected success or failure in their own enterprise, in a competing enterprise, or in the industry. Second, a gap between what is and what could be in a market, process, product, or service. For example, in the 19th century, the paper industry concentrated on the 10% of each tree that became wood pulp and totally neglected the possibilities in the remaining 90%, which became waste. Third, innovation in a process, product, or service, whether inside or outside the enterprise or its industry. Fourth, changes in industry structure and market structure. Fifth, demographics. Sixth, changes in mindset, values, perception, mood, or meaning. And seventh, new knowledge or a new technology. Effective executives also make sure that problems don't overwhelm opportunities. In most companies, the first page of the monthly management report lists key problems. It's far wiser to list opportunities on the first page and leave problems for the second page. Unless there's a true catastrophe, problems aren't discussed in management meetings until opportunities have been analyzed and properly dealt with. Staffing is another important aspect of being opportunity-focused. Effective executives put their best people on opportunities rather than on problems. One way to staff for opportunities is to ask each member of the management group to prepare two lists every 6 months, a list of opportunities for the entire enterprise and a list of the best performing people throughout the enterprise. These are discussed, then melded into two master lists, and the best people are matched with the best opportunities. In Japan, by the way, this matchup is considered a major HR task in a big corporation or government department. That practice is one of the key strengths of Japanese business. Make meetings productive. the most visible, powerful, and arguably effective non-governmental executive in the America of World War II and the years thereafter, was not a businessman. It was Francis Cardinal Spellman, the head of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York and advisor to several U.S. presidents. When Spellman took over, the diocese was bankrupt and totally demoralized. His successor inherited the leadership position in the American Catholic Church. Spellman often said that during his waking hours, he was alone only twice each day, for 25 minutes each time. When he said Mass in his private chapel after getting up in the morning, and when he said his evening prayers before going to bed. Otherwise, he was always with people in a meeting, starting at breakfast with one Catholic organization and ending at dinner with another. Top executives aren't quite as imprisoned as the Archbishop of a major Catholic diocese, but every study of the executive workday has found that even junior executives and professionals are with other people, that is, in a meeting of some sort, more than half of every business day. The only exceptions are a few senior researchers. Even a conversation with only one other person is a meeting, hence, if they are to be effective, executives must make meetings productive. They must make sure that meetings are work sessions rather than bull sessions. The key to running an effective meeting is to decide in advance what kind of meeting it will be. Different kinds of meetings require different forms of preparation and different results. A meeting to prepare a statement, an announcement, or a press release. For this to be productive, one member has to prepare a draft beforehand. At the meeting's end, a pre-appointed member has to take responsibility for disseminating the final text. A meeting to make an announcement, for example, an organizational change. This meeting should be confined to the announcement and a discussion about it. A meeting in which one member reports. Nothing but the report should be discussed. A meeting in which several or all members report. Either there should be no discussion at all, or the discussion should be limited to questions for clarification. Alternatively, for each report there could be a short discussion in which all participants may ask questions. If this is the format, the report should be distributed to all participants well before the meeting. At this kind of meeting, each report should be limited to a preset time, for example, 15 minutes. A meeting to inform the convening executive. The executive should listen and ask questions. He or she should sum up, but not make a presentation. A meeting whose only function is to allow the participants to be in the executive's presence. The Cardinal Spellman's breakfast and dinner meetings were of that kind. There's no way to make these meetings productive. They're the penalties of rank. Senior executives are effective to the extent to which they can prevent such meetings from encroaching on their workdays. Spellman, for instance, was effective in large part because he confined such meetings to breakfast and dinner and kept the rest of his working day free of them. Making a meeting productive takes a good deal of self-discipline. It requires that executives determine what kind of meeting is appropriate and then stick to that format. It's also necessary to terminate the meeting as soon as its specific purpose has been accomplished. Good executives don't raise another matter for discussion. They sum up and adjourn. Good follow-up is just as important as the meeting itself. The great master of follow-up was Alfred Sloan, the most effective business executive I've ever known. Sloan, who headed General Motors from the 1920s until the 1950s, spent most of his 6 working days a week in meetings, 3 days a week in formal committee meetings with a set membership, the other 3 days in ad hoc meetings with individual GM executives or with a small group of executives. At the beginning of a formal meeting, Sloan announced the meeting's purpose. He then listened. He never took notes, and he rarely spoke except to clarify a confusing point. At the end, he summed up, thanked the participants, and left. Then he immediately wrote a short memo addressed to one attendee of the meeting. In that note, he summarized the discussion and its conclusions and spelled out any work assignment decided upon in the meeting, including a decision to hold another meeting on the subject or to study an issue. He specified the deadline and the executive who was to be accountable for the assignment. He sent a copy of the memo to everyone who'd been present at the meeting. It was through these memos, each a small masterpiece, that Sloan made himself into an outstandingly effective executive. Effective executives know that any given meeting is either productive or a total waste of time. Think and say we. The final practice is this. Don't think or say I, think and say we. Effective executives know that they have ultimate responsibility, which can be neither shared nor delegated, but they have authority only because they have the trust of the organization. This means that they think of the needs and the opportunities of the organization before they think of their own needs and opportunities. This one may sound simple. It isn't, but it needs to be strictly observed. We've just reviewed 8 practices of effective executives. I'm going to throw in one final bonus practice. This one's so important that I'll elevate it to the level of a rule. Listen first, speak last. Effective executives differ widely in their personalities, strengths, weaknesses, values, and beliefs. All they have in common is that they get the right things done. Some are born effective, but the demand is much too great to be satisfied by extraordinary talent. Effectiveness is a discipline, and like every discipline, effectiveness can be learned and must be earned.
Chapter 1. Effectiveness can be learned. To be effective is the job of the executive. To effect and to execute are, after all, near synonyms. Whether he works in a business or in a hospital, in a government agency or in a labor union, in a university or in the army, the executive is first of all expected to get the right things done, and this is simply that he is expected to be effective. Yet men of high effectiveness are conspicuous by their absence in executive jobs. High intelligence is common enough among executives. Imagination is far from rare. The level of knowledge tends to be high. But there seems to be little correlation between a man's effectiveness and his intelligence, his imagination, or his knowledge. Brilliant men are often strikingly ineffectual. They fail to realize that the brilliant insight isn't by itself achievement. They never have learned that insights become effectiveness only through hard, systematic work. Conversely, in every organization there are some highly effective plotters. While others rush around in the frenzy and busyness which very bright people so often confuse with creativity, the plotter puts one foot in front of the other and gets there first, like the tortoise in the old fable. Intelligence, imagination, and knowledge are essential resources, but only effectiveness converts them into results. By themselves, they only set limits to what can be attained. Why we need effective executives. All this should be obvious, but why then has so little attention been paid to effectiveness in an age in which there are mountains of books and articles on every other aspect of the executive's tasks? One reason for this neglect is that effectiveness is the specific technology of the knowledge worker within an organization. Until recently, there was no more than a handful of these around. For manual work, we need only efficiency, that is, the ability to do things right rather than the ability to get the right things done. The manual worker can always be judged in terms of the quantity and quality of a definable and discrete output, such as a pair of shoes. We've learned how to measure efficiency and how to define quality in manual work during the last 100 years, to the point where we've been able to multiply the output of the individual worker tremendously. Formerly, the manual worker, whether machine operator or frontline soldier, predominated in all organizations. Few people of effectiveness were needed, those at the top who gave the orders that others carried out. They were so small a fraction of the total work population that we could, rightly or wrongly, take their effectiveness for granted. We could depend on the supply of naturals, the few people in any area of human endeavor who somehow know what the rest of us have to learn the hard way. This was true not only of business and the army. It's hard to realize today that government during the American Civil War 100 years ago meant the merest handful of people. Lincoln's Secretary of War had fewer than 50 civilian subordinates, most of them not executives and policymakers, but telegraph clerks. The entire Washington establishment of the U.S. government in Theodore Roosevelt's time, around 1900, could be comfortably housed in any one of the government buildings along the Mall today. The hospital of yesterday did not know any of the health service professionals, the x-ray and lab technicians, the dietitians and therapists, the social workers, and so on, of whom it now employs as many as 250 for every 100 patients. Apart from a few nurses, there were only cleaning women, cooks, and maids. The physician was the knowledge worker, with the nurse as his aide. In other words, up to recent times, the major problem of organization was efficiency in the performance of the manual worker, who did what he had been told to do. Knowledge workers weren't predominant in organization. In fact, only a small fraction of the knowledge workers of earlier days were part of an organization.
Most of them worked by themselves as professionals, at best with a clerk. Their effectiveness, or lack of effectiveness, concerned only themselves and affected only themselves. Today, however, the large knowledge organization is the central reality. Modern society is a society of large, organized institutions. In every one of them, including the armed services, the center of gravity has shifted to the knowledge worker, the man who puts to work what he has between his ears rather than the brawn of his muscles or the skill of his hands. Increasingly, the majority of people who have been schooled to use knowledge, theory, and concept rather than physical force or manual skill work in an organization and are effective insofar as they can make a contribution to the organization. Now effectiveness can no longer be taken for granted. Now it can no longer be neglected. The imposing system of measurements and tests which we've developed for manual work, from industrial engineering to quality control, isn't applicable to knowledge work. There are few things less pleasing to the Lord and less productive than an engineering department that rapidly turns out beautiful blueprints for the wrong product. Working on the right things is what makes knowledge work effective. This isn't capable of being measured by any of the yardsticks for manual work. The knowledge worker can't be supervised closely or in detail. He can only be helped, but he must direct himself, and he must direct himself toward performance and contribution, that is, toward effectiveness. A cartoon in the New Yorker magazine some time ago showed an office on the door of which was the legend, Chas Smith, General Sales Manager, Ajax Soap Company. The walls were bare except for a big sign saying, Think. The man in the office had his feet propped up on his desk and was blowing smoke rings at the ceiling. Outside, two older men went by, the one saying to the other, But how can we be sure that Smith thinks soap? One can indeed never be sure what the knowledge worker thinks, and yet thinking is his specific work. It's his doing. The motivation of the knowledge worker depends on his being effective, on his being able to achieve. If effectiveness is lacking in his work, his commitment to work and to contribution will soon wither, and he'll become a time server going through the motions from 9 to 5. The knowledge worker doesn't produce something that is effective by itself. He doesn't produce a physical product, a ditch, a pair of shoes, a machine part. He produces knowledge, ideas, information. By themselves, these products are useless. Somebody else, another man of knowledge, has to take them as his input and convert them into his output before they have any reality. The greatest wisdom not applied to action and behavior is meaningless data. The knowledge worker, therefore, must do something which a manual worker need not do. He must provide effectiveness. He can't depend on the utility his output carries with it, as does a well-made pair of shoes. The knowledge worker is the one factor of production through which the highly developed societies and economies of today, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and also increasingly the Soviet Union, become and remain competitive. This is particularly true of the United States. The only resource in respect to which America can possibly have a competitive advantage is education. American education may leave a good deal to be desired, but it is massive beyond anything poorer societies can afford, for education is the most expensive capital investment we have ever known. A Ph.D. in the natural sciences represents $100,000 to $200,000 of social capital investment. Even the boy who graduates from college without any specific professional competence represents an investment of $50,000 or more. This only a very rich society can afford. Education is the one area, therefore, in which the richest of all societies, the United States, has a genuine advantage, provided it can make the knowledge worker productive, and productivity for the knowledge worker means the ability to get the right things done. It means effectiveness. Who is an executive? Every knowledge worker in modern organization is an executive. If, by virtue of his position or knowledge, he's responsible for a contribution that materially affects the capacity of the organization to perform and to obtain results. This may be the capacity of a business to bring out a new product or to obtain a larger share of a given market. It may be the capacity of a hospital to provide bedside care to its patients, and so on. Such a man or woman must make decisions. He can't just carry out orders. He must take responsibility for his contribution, and he is supposed, by virtue of his knowledge, to be better equipped to make the right decision than anyone else. He may be overridden, he may be demoted or fired, but so long as he has the job, the goals, the standards, and the contribution are in his keeping. Most managers are executives, though not all, but many non-managers are also becoming executives.